Hello and welcome to All Things New Orleans. I'm your host, Eve Tro, on this, the final day of 2015. Jack Hopke is away. He'll be back next week. Today, we devote the entire program to one of the most interesting news stories of the year. Burl Cain became warden of Louisiana's state penitentiary at Angola in 1995, and he's run the notorious prison plantation the past 20 years. Heavyset with flowing white hair, the subject of documentaries and books, Cain is known for overseeing the prison absolutely on his own terms. Guided, he says, by a Christian faith that believes in redemption for inmates, many of them violent offenders serving life sentences, Cain became a popular public speaker in the corrections field. Today is Burl Cain's last day. He resigns as warden of Angola January 1st. He's called the decision devastating. Cain has been subject to many criminal investigations over the years, but never charged. It was after a big story detailing a shady real estate deal in the Advocate newspaper that he announced his resignation. It showed how Cain had done a real estate deal with two parties who were very close to Angola inmates. The reporters of that story and several more stories that followed are Maya Lau and Gordon Russell. They came to WWNO to talk to me in depth about their investigative work on Burl Cain. Maya and Gordon, thanks for talking to WWNO.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So I'll start with you, Gordon. Burl Cain is an iconic figure. You have been following him for quite some time. How would you characterize his time at Angola, his reign, if you will?
I would characterize his reign as controversial, but also he's become sort of, as you said, an iconic figure. He's sort of a rock star in the corrections world, I would say. Maybe America's most famous warden, both because Angola is such a notorious and sort of storied prison. It's the largest by area maximum security prison in the country. It has a past of a lot of violence. A lot of that's been calmed down in the last few decades. Most everyone there is doing a life sentence. Most of the prisoners die there. It's a former slave plantation. Some people have called it a modern plantation with inmates laboring in the fields.
Under the supervision of guards who are on horseback. I mean, the images from Angola are striking and have been transmitted all over the world.
Correct. And then you've got Burl Cain as this, seems like he just walked off of a movie set, kind of a big, heavyset guy with long hair who's got this interesting mix of compassion towards the prisoners and law and order toughness. And he's a very strong Christian, and he's really pushed a program of religious instruction and getting inmates to get involved in church activities on the prison. And, but, you know, a lot of people have lauded him for that. It's been, you know, somewhat controversial as well, but that's something that he would say has given prisoners hope, I guess you could say.
On the other side, though, his time at Angola has also been characterized by a lot of scandals in the ways that he attempts to use inmates as labor for any number of things.
Yeah, he's got a really rich history of side deals, which we chronicled in a recent story, and we really only scratched the surface. And some of this even precedes his time at Angola. He's been there 21 years, but he's been involved in all kinds of business deals in which often inmate labor is the commodity that's being traded or that makes the deal go. There's been some evidence in some cases that Burl Cain was personally profiting from these. In other cases, it had that appearance, but there was no evidence of it.
Mm. So how do you, as journalists, weigh that, say, okay, these are tips that we should follow up on?
I mean, yeah, I think that that's what's so interesting about him is that he is so controversial. On the one hand, he has a view of inmate rehabilitation that many people see as revolutionary. Certainly in the most incarcerating state in the nation, you wouldn't necessarily expect a warden who really believes that inmates can redeem themselves, that they shouldn't necessarily be defined by the worst thing that they've ever done. He doesn't necessarily think that they should all be released, but he thinks that they should have a life and an evolution inside prison. And then at the same time, he has this shadow over him of all these curious, controversial side deals. So I think that it's just the amount of stories that are there. It's the amount of tips that you get and sources that come forward that kind of makes it hard to ignore.
So, Gordon, when you're talking about writing stories about Burl Cain, how do you decide where to even begin?
Well, in this case, I guess we were lucky to have a tip that seemed worth investigating. And it was, like Maya said, we had pieces of this from various sources, and they were all a little bit wrong. But we did have enough that we were able to start piecing something together. And we were, you know, a number of people told us we should look into these land deals in West Feliciana Parish in a development called the Bluffs North, which ultimately became this story that we did, which revealed that Burl Cain had done business with relatives and friends of two inmates under his care who had seemed to get some favorable treatment from him. But getting there was kind of a tortuous path. And another reporter who worked with us on this story, Steve Hardy, he spent some time in the courthouse up there going over land records, spent a good bit of time. And it was, you know, it was quite complicated. I mean, Burl Cain, he acquired about 150 acres of land there. Then it was parceled up. His concept was to build this kind of subdivision of large estates. And then he took on these investors over time, and so it was a little bit tricky to piece together exactly what happened. This all happened against the backdrop of the national economic recession as well, which made it further complicated. I mean, it had the appearance that maybe he got in a little bit too deep. You know, he had taken out loans. He paid over $2 million for this property, and then it was right before the recession began, and then he ended up taking on these partners. And
some of those partners, it turned out, were related to inmates.
Exactly. There are two prominent real estate developers that were involved in this, and one of them has a stepson who's in the prison system who killed two people. Developer's name is Charles Chatelaine, and the second guy is a guy named Will Orso, who's now deceased, and he had an inmate that he had become very close to who he was trying to get a new trial for. And Burl Cain played a role in trying to get that guy a new trial. He went and interviewed another inmate on his deathbed who was trying to take responsibility for the murder that this first inmate was serving a life sentence for.
I think the tricky thing that we dealt with a lot is, how do we tell this story given that there are so many people that don't want to go on the record and so many people that don't even want to be referred to in any oblique way? Like, we have to act like we never talked to them. They can't be referred to as a source. So you kind of have to tell the story through documents and getting pointed to those. I remember we first had the name Will Orso, but didn't know much more. And it was through calling around that we ended up getting good sources that that came through unexpected means, that came through actually people that didn't want to talk to us, who inadvertently spurred other people to get in touch with us, or from people that we wouldn't think would want to talk to us, who unbeknownst to us had some sort of personal vendetta that made them want to talk. So a lot of it was, you know, using all these unnamed sources to point us to documents.
You call this the one last side deal that brought down Burl Cain. That implies a long line of other side deals. What is your sense of what has been going on over the past 20 years and perhaps before that? And why haven't any of the previous side deals taken him down or even seemed to bring any consequences to him?
We made a list through researching our library and doing our own research, and there was, yeah, I don't know, Maya, maybe there was a dozen side deals that we cataloged. Going back to the early 1980s, the very first one, we didn't mention all of these in our reporting, but back in the early 1980s, he came under fire because the legislature discovered that he had ordered a bunch of computers at the Department of Corrections, and they were never taken out of the boxes. There was about $100,000 worth of equipment, I think, and there was this legislative hearings about how did this happen, and he's just been a guy who's been in one controversy after another. I guess the common thread in most of these has been that it looks bad, but there's nothing that ties him. There's nothing that proves he committed a crime. In some cases, there's not a direct allegation of one. There were a couple of times, and we highlighted these in a recent story, that there was sort of an accusation like that. In one memorable case, Daniel Bergner, the author who wrote God of the Rodeo, which was a book based on spending almost a year, I think, at Angola with sort of unfettered access. Well, his access was cut off at some point by Warden Cain, who said he wanted a cut, a big cut of the author's advance.
Yeah, $50,000 of his $60,000 advance basically demanded that money in exchange for continued access to the prison to do his writing.
Correct. And so Bergner ended up taking the warden to court and ended up having his access restored, and he did not pay the bribe, whatever you want to call it. Kane always denied this story, but that was one memorable instance. There was another one that we wrote about in which this was when Burl Kane was at Dixon Correctional Institute, and he had worked out a deal with a private company to set up a recycling plant on the prison grounds. And at the same time, he had gotten himself a side deal where he was going to go around and try to land other deals for this company, and he was going to be paid a commission. And that one, again, seems like a pretty clear-cut violation of at least of state ethics laws and maybe more. But by the time that came out, it had already sort of fallen apart.
Collapsed.
And I guess nobody had the sort of intestinal fortitude or whatever to do anything.
Our work really built upon years of work by law enforcement and other reporters who really laid the groundwork for this. You asked, you know, why has Kane never really been brought down before? I think that we had a sort of perfect storm with the run-up to the governor's inauguration. There's certainly a sense that, you know, a change is happening, and maybe pressure was put on certain people to, you know, get rid of anybody who's controversial. I also think Kane has been investigated by the FBI more than once. And, you know, what we wrote about in that first investigation, it wasn't necessarily criminal. It wasn't necessarily a violation of laws. But I think that what we were able to do, and I think that this is where journalism triumphs, is that all we did was shine a light on something that seemed weird. And we had other people agree that it was weird. And then, in, you know, the second big story, we just really strung together all of the scams and, you know, allegations of scams that Kane has been involved in, and put it into a package where people could see the through line. I kind of think that you know, it's an accumulation of all these things that sort of ended up the way it did.
This is All Things New Orleans. Our show this week is an in-depth look at reporting on Burl Kane. The longtime warden of Angola Prison steps down January 1st. Reporters for The Advocate newspaper, Maya Lau and Gordon Russell, are the journalists whose series on Kane preceded his resignation. I asked Maya Lau about any particularly surprising turns in the reporting.
What I would say was more of a breakthrough for me was when we got the wife of Charles Chatelain, who is one of the wealthy land investors, to talk to us. When you're reporting, you have this idea in your mind that you need to talk to everyone because you never know what'll happen. And you have this kind of list of people, almost like you're ticking them off the list. And I think certain people in the back of your mind, you feel like because of who they are and because of who they're related to, they're not going to want to talk to me, but I have to call them anyway. You don't know that they won't talk to you. And, you know, she picked up the phone. I introduced myself as a journalist and we started talking, and she ended up, you know, confirming a few things. One of which is that it was her understanding that, you know, this whole land deal had been investigated by the feds, and that it was because of that that her son, who had been at Angola but assigned to the governor's mansion, was moved away from the governor's mansion, supposedly in order to kind of, you know, divert attention and make everything look like, you know, there's nothing to see here. I can't really speak to why she talked to me, but she did.
What did it feel like for both of you when you heard that Burl Cain had announced he would step down as warden of Angola? Gordon?
I was shocked, frankly. I mean, we'd been hearing that something like that might happen, but it came a lot quicker than I thought it would. And I guess I thought, this is a guy who's weathered so many controversies over his career, and we knew he wanted to stay on. I just thought it was going to take more than this to cause him to leave, and we still haven't got the full backstory, but it made me think that this, you know, that he had been told that he wasn't going to weather this one. And I think that may refer back to what Maya referred to as the perfect storm of the timing on this. We happen to be in sort of an interregnum between governors, where the new governor may, I don't know what he thinks about Burl Cain, but he maybe just doesn't want to inherit a controversy. And so maybe some emissaries said, look, this is, you need to go. We don't know that for sure.
You know, Cain goes on WAFB and announces it. And, you know, we were racing around trying to get it officially confirmed and then putting together the story that we did. You know, he told WAFB that part of the reason why he was stepping down was that we had submitted more questions to him for a new story. And that was the one that we ended up publishing on Friday. And he said something like, you know, and then I just decided it was time to go.
I want to come back to Daniel Bergner for a moment. You quote him in the piece a couple of times, and one of the quotes is after he has gone through this alleged bribery scheme with Burl Cain, and he says, "How could I have deceived myself for so long, diminished so thoroughly what now seemed Cain's primary interest in running prisons, meaning that his real interest has been financial more so than this reformation and education and enlightenment of inmates." Do you see those two sides as being at odds with each other? I mean, could it be possible that he would truly believe in the power of Christian redemption for this inmate population and yet also be interested financially?
I mean, I think it's totally possible. I think people are complicated. It's totally possible to have those contradictions within one person. And a lot of the crooks I've covered over the years have been charming people, and they've been charismatic people. And oftentimes that's what allows them access to make these kinds of deals. I also think that in his own self-interest and in the interest of everybody, he may have, you know, a prison in which inmates are not rioting or engaged in violence is a good thing, regardless of what you might be doing on the side. I mean, essentially, he wants to be left alone, and he wants people to think that he's running a good prison. And to the extent he can do that, I think he's less apt to lose his job. He's less apt to have people meddling in his business.
You know, we kind of make it out to be like there's these two sides to him, this like Christian church building side, and then this side to him that's involved in these scams. But some of them have actually been intertwined. You know, in the mid-2000s, which we wrote about, you know, there was a rodeo contractor who said that Burl Cain tried to force the guy to donate to a prison chapel fund in exchange for favorable treatment in getting a certain bid. And so a lot of these things are actually kind of linked. I actually came across a clip in which Burl Cain said, you know, I didn't want this job. I knew how violent the prison was. I was worried about it. But I said, you know, you'd have to pay me an enormous amount of money. And, you know, and they did, or, you know, something like that. So I feel like money has been at least alluded to early on in his tenure. And when you think about it, inmates are the perfect laborers. You know, you have control over them. And the public, I think especially in Louisiana, doesn't take a lot of pity on them. So the idea that they need to serve out their sentence in whatever way the wardens think is necessary is, you know, an accepted idea.
I can't speak to whether he really believes in it or not. I think that it does give him some cover in terms of, you know, he's able to show off these chapels that he's built. He's got all these inmate ministers. He's gotten, you know, hundreds of journalists to write pieces about how he's turned this place around. He's got people visiting the prison from all over the world. He gets speaking engagements. I mean, in fact, it's become sort of a side business, too, is Burl Cain, the consultant and the public speaker, the guy who turned around this bloody prison. he runs that place, you know, his authority until now has been unquestioned, and I think that's given him a lot of free rein to pursue whatever other things he wants to pursue.
Yeah, I mean, he has said in at least one news interview, I think this was in The Atlantic, that he doesn't attend church. And I'm not sure, you know, if his faith is more personal or what, but, you know, you would think that maybe he would attend church. He certainly brought up, you know, the topic of Christianity in refuting our articles, saying that we questioned his Christianity and we didn't. So I don't know if it's just a theme that works for him, or I think it's like Gordon is saying, I think it's possible to be a complicated, multifaceted person who has, you know, all of these sides are going on.
So where do your investigations go from here?
We probably can't say too much, but we do have, we've been getting a lot of tips. We had a lot of tips before we published these stories that we were looking into, and we're still looking into those, and more have come in. One of the things about this, when we started this, there were a lot of people who were either afraid to talk or would only talk off the record. This guy cast a real long shadow, and people were worried about retribution and losing their jobs. A lot of people who work at the Department of Corrections, for instance, and even people who used to work there still remain afraid for one reason or another. So I think we have a lot of interesting things we're going to be looking into. I think we're trying to look more broadly at how the system has been run and whether Louisiana is kind of the incarceration capital of America. And the question, I guess, is part of the reason for that the inmates are the lifeblood of a financial system that a lot of these guys have grown to depend on.
Yeah, I think the question of Burl's legacy, what legacy does he really leave behind, is critical, and that's something we're going to be looking at. And, you know, honestly, there's, I think, a lot more that we just can't really predict. We've been surprised in this reporting throughout, and so I'm interested to see as we go forward what other things will come out, which I couldn't possibly envision right now.
What happens next at Angola with Burl Cain announcing that he's leaving? There will be new leadership coming in. What does that process look like, and what kind of changes might we see at the penitentiary?
Well, it should be said that Burl Cain will probably be an influence in some way. I don't think that he's just going to go away entirely. I know that the interim person, Daryl Vinoy, that they've assigned to look over Angola is somebody who's worked under Cain in the past. I think it would be surprising if Cain just sort of disappeared. I think that he might have influence whether or not he's in the official role that he was in. But I really couldn't say.
I would agree with that and say that the interim warden is somebody who worked under Burl for a long time. The other thing that, you know, will probably ensure that his legacy will continue there is that Burl Cain has several, he has two sons and a son-in-law who have fairly high-ranking positions within the department as well. So as Maya said, the Burl Cain era, he may be gone, but the Burl Cain era lives on, I think.
Gordon Russell and Maya Lau, reporters with the Advocate newspaper in New Orleans and Baton Rouge, on their series about Angola warden Burl Cain. He steps down January 1st. They now report that Cain is being investigated for criminal wrongdoing by the Inspector General's Office and State Police, with cooperation from the Department of Public Safety and Corrections. Maya Lau and Gordon Russell's reporting is at theadvocate.com. And that's it for this week's edition of All Things New Orleans. I'm Eve Troe. Jack Hopke is back next week. Happy New Year from everyone at WWNO, New Orleans Public Radio, and keep listening for more great stories in 2016.